written content has a lot of advantages over video content in the sense that like it's searchable and like highlightable and copy and pasteable and stuff like that, right? But I think video content is easier to charge a higher price for, which can be really important if you don't have a huge audience and you need to make sure that you're going to get a good return on your time invested.
You're listening to the Yo Podcast with Rob Hope.
Adam Wathen is one part metalhead, two parts online education juggernaut. Over the past few years, Adam has distilled his obsessive development research into several online courses and books, achieving millions of dollars in sales. We rap about SaaS versus once-off payments, Pantera versus Slayer, the advantage of multi-tier pricing, and of course, his rapidly growing CSS framework, Tailwind CSS. Yo, Adam, welcome to the show, dude.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I was chatting to some Canadian dude the other day, and he says, if I ever go visit, I should eat beaver tails. What on earth is that about?
You know what? It's funny that I haven't even actually had a beaver tail, but I think like my understanding of it, and someone will correct me if I'm wrong, is it's basically like a pastry, like the sort of thing that you would get at like a fair or at like an amusement park. But yeah. Junk food.
So after some research, I learned Canada is the world's most educated country. Over half of its residents have college degrees. Do you think the university system is still broken?
Interesting. Yeah, I think it sucks. I don't have a college degree. And I've been to two post-secondary institutions. I think there's a lot of things that, a lot of careers that people kind of want that I don't think are best served by like learning sitting in a classroom and like doing assignments and stuff like that. Especially like web development is a good example of this. I wish like that the training and education for web development was more like what it is for like becoming an electrician or something, where there's like some classroom elements, but a lot of it is just you go out in the field and work with other people more experienced than you and build real things and learn from them. And I think there's also a bunch of other problems, like specifically where we are. I think they have similar systems in the States. I don't know what it's like in the rest of the world, but we sort of have like two classes of higher education. There's like university and there's college, which I think in the US is kind of like college and community college. And I went to university first, and university is considered much more prestigious, right? And those are like your four-year degree programs, and college is like a two-year diploma program typically. Mm-hmm. And all throughout school, like all throughout high school and everything is set up to sort of brainwash you to believe that like going to university is what smart people do. That's like,
yeah,
that you should be proud and consider a success if you get into university, but college is okay as a backup plan sort of thing. And like even when you're in high school, you have like, you have university math and you have college math, and like college math is supposed to be easier and university math is supposed to be harder, and you choose the course, you know, based on what educational institution you want to go to at the end of the day. So I found that like when I went to college for software engineering, I learned way more and way more practical things than I did when I went to university for computer science. And it costs way less money and you're there for way less time, and there's more like co-op work opportunities and stuff like that. So I don't know, the whole system to me is just kind of it just kind of encourages people to spend lots of money for this like status of having this piece of paper, when maybe that's not actually the best way to get a job in the field that you actually want to get a job in. So yeah, I don't know, it's not great, it's okay. I wish more like high schools and stuff would not kind of get people believing that like one option is necessarily better than the other. I think it'd be better if they were evaluated sort of on what your goals are. I think university is great if you are just interested in learning, but not great if you're interested in being trained, you know what I mean? And I also think there's lots of options out there that don't necessarily require that at all. Like I wish they taught anything about like entrepreneurship in high school, because I didn't know anything about it. Like I didn't know that one option was like invent your own job, then you don't need a piece of paper because you don't need anyone to hire you.
Actually, thinking back, I had a final exam for Delphi, and I did it on a piece of paper. It was like a 30 mark one question, program a traffic light?
That was the whole question. So no more detail than that.
Blank page.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So you're the author of, you know, Test Driven Laravel, Refactoring to Collections, Advanced View Component Design, and more recently, Refactoring UI. Do you feel you make more impact than the average university lecturer?
Interesting question. I think probably in a lot of ways, yes, for the sorts of people who buy my products, I think, because it's the stuff that I try and teach is so much more specific and focused, I guess. Like, I would even say, like, a lot of, even though I had a pretty decent experience in college when I went back a second time and, you know, went for software engineering instead of computer science, I would say that still, like, the vast majority of my learning was, like, self-directed from other people's books and courses and stuff. Like, things that were, like, really crucial in my learning journey were things like Uncle Bob's books, for example.
Yeah.
Or like Gary Bernhardt's Destroy All Software, online screencasts and stuff like that. I learned way more from that stuff than I did in college. Like, I learned a bunch of things in college, and sometimes it's interesting when I notice that, like, I know something that a lot of other web developers don't know. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
because
yeah.
That's the sort of thing they taught us in college, like bit masking or like, array linearization in C or, you know, some other obscure thing. But for the most part, yeah, I think like most of the most valuable things I learned were stuff that I learned online from people making the sorts of things that I make. So I bet it's true that a lot of the stuff that I've done has had a bigger impact on the people who've purchased it than what they learned in school. And I try to say that in a modest way, but I'm also trying to be realistic too. And I think it's probably true.
Would you call yourself a builder or a teacher?
I like to think of myself more as a builder for sure. But yeah, it is interesting that, I make a living teaching stuff at the moment anyways. So.
Great. So I want to break into a little intermission I like to call no context. So simply shoot back either of the two options I give you, no context needed at all.
Yeah.
Honey or maple syrup?
Neither.
It's gotta be either.
Honey.
Les Paul or Stratocaster?
Stratocaster.
Fender or Marshall?
Marshall.
Open source software or recurring revenue?
Recurring revenue.
WWE or IPF?
IPF.
Clandestine or Left Hand Path?
Left Hand Path.
And lastly, Slayer or Pantera?
Slayer.
Dude, I did a deep dive in your Twitter and I discovered you saw both Pantera and Slayer in 2001. What the fuck?
Yeah, that was my first real concert that I ever went to, actually. It was awesome.
Being a guitarist, to see Dimebag, I mean, do his thing must be like a huge highlight here.
Yeah, big time. Especially like at the time, you don't really realize like how big of a deal that's actually going to be in history.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like, that was the last time they ever played in Canada.
Really?
And now he's dead, so no one's ever going to see him play. You know what I mean? Like, I think Damage Plan might have played in Canada, but
not the same.
Yeah, who cares, right?
Okay, Rad. So I just want to deep dive into the execution of your courses, you know, break down different mediums, and hopefully the listeners can take something into their own products.
Sure.
So all your courses use Gumroad for payments and product delivery. Why them? And, you know, with this volume you guys are getting now, why not something custom, maybe integrated with Stripe, just to shave off a tad of the commission?
Yeah, good question. So I think this is like a common developer mindset.
Yeah.
I could do everything myself, whatever. Okay, a couple reasons that I prefer to use Gumroad versus rolling something myself. And for history's sake, I used Gumroad for my first product. Then I used Stripe for my second product. Quickly added Gumroad as well for the second product, and then I've used Gumroad ever since. So I did try that for that exact same reason.
Awesome.
Main thing, information for reference, Stripe is like 2.7% plus 30 cents. Gumroad is 3.5% plus 30 cents. So just a little bit more percentage wise.
Yep.
Plus you pay like $20 a month for your Gumroad account.
For the pro features.
Which is nothing. It sounds like that might be substantial until you recognize that PayPal is very, very expensive compared to Stripe. So PayPal advertises 2.7% plus 30 cents, I think, as well. But that's only for transactions between two people in the same country in the local currency of that country. So if I was based in the US, this might change the math a little bit. But because I'm in Canada, a very small percentage of our sales come from people in Canada because it's such a small country population-wise compared to the US, right? Most of our sales are from the US and Europe. So immediately, that means with PayPal support, we end up paying closer to 4%, sometimes more than 4% for PayPal transactions plus the 30 cents. So by using Gumroad, every single transaction that happens with PayPal, I actually save money on than if I used PayPal directly myself.
Wow.
This ends up being fine because Gumroad gets a better rate from PayPal than regular people do anyways. So they're not losing money on it, and they're making a little bit of money on the percentage that they get from Stripe.
Interesting.
Even just there, just looking at like the pure math, the fact that by like using Gumroad allows people to pay us with PayPal, that opens up like a huge potential market that wouldn't otherwise use a credit card, which is honestly like almost all of Europe. Like nobody there uses credit cards for everything, for anything, sorry. So many people don't even have credit cards. It's just like culturally, it's not the same as it is in North America. So it's important to have PayPal support. And by using Gumroad, PayPal support is cheaper. And then the other factors are in Canada, I have to collect sales tax from other Canadian customers, right? So if someone from Ontario buys my course, I have to charge them 13% in sales tax. And I don't have this all built out online because it's very, very complicated because it's different rates for different provinces and stuff like that. So, and I also don't want people from Canada to feel like they're paying more money than other people are necessarily. So what I end up doing is people pay, like say they buy my test-driven Laravel course for $249. They pay $249. And then every quarter, I have to like go through every single Stripe transaction, find the Canadians, find their postal code, figure out what province they're from, reverse calculate what amount of that $249 should have been sales tax, such that, you know, some number times 1.13 comes out to $249. Then I have to give that money to the government. So I actually am making less money on every sale coming from Canada than I would if they had bought from Gumroad, because with Gumroad, they act as like a merchant of record, which means they are technically like a reseller of my product and they're paying me a royalty. So when someone buys from Gumroad, they get a receipt that says Gumroad LLC. Their invoice says you bought this from Gumroad, not from Adam. And then I get a weekly payout from Gumroad. And then for my own bookkeeping purposes, the only thing I have to keep track of is those weekly payouts from Gumroad. So I have like 52 entries in a spreadsheet. That's all my bookkeeping for the whole year. Whereas if I do things like I did for my test-driven Laravel course, I have thousands and thousands of Stripe transactions that I'm individually responsible for determining the location of the customers and how much sales tax they should pay. So the administrative overhead is just like absurd compared to what it is with Gumroad. And then on top of that, you get all these like features that are built into Gumroad that I would have to build myself otherwise, like coupon codes and all that sort of stuff. And even just like the delivery of the files, like I don't have to pay anything for bandwidth because all that stuff is hosted on Gumroad. So I haven't like done the math to know for sure, but like I would be shocked if I make less money using Gumroad than I would using Stripe and PayPal directly. Not even like accounting for all the time that I would lose and all the administrative junk. So going forward, I will never use that stuff myself, or I will never do it myself, ever.
Now that was a great bit of advice. But I'll let you in on another little secret. The Yo Podcast soundtrack is now streaming on Spotify. Just head over to robhope.com/Spotify to kick off those rockin' beats. Back to you, Rob.
So the next one's super selfish, but I think it's going to be good for context in the lessons. But I'm working on a landing page masterclass course for 2020 over on One Page Love, and I'm banging my head against the wall about pricing. What are your thoughts on a free pricing tier for an online course?
Yeah.
Let's go freemium, where like there's a free version of the course, diluted, 6 chapters, but there's a like more comprehensive course at a premium rate.
I think it probably could work. I haven't done it before. I think I prefer to have a more clear separation between like stuff that's free and stuff that's paid. And there's stuff that's free and it's just free, like no strings attached. And then there's stuff that's like clearly commercial. And like, if you want it, like you pay money for it. I think that feels simpler to me. But again, I haven't tested it. I've never done like something where there's like an explicitly free version. Like I've certainly all my courses, you can like, there's free content for sure.
Yeah.
But I've never really like positioned it as like the free version of the course or whatever. It's like, you can get access to, you know, so enter your email and I'll send you a link to watch like the first 6 lessons for free or something like that. Which I think works really well. Yeah. Yeah. More like a teaser than like an actual like free edition.
Okay. Teaser.
It depends. Like, I guess what job you want the free stuff to do. I would be more inclined to just like put together some separate free content, like a really good blog post or something. And use that to kind of build some authority around that topic and have people who want more or want it in like a different format to go do the paid thing. Like a lot of my stuff, like my Vue course, for example, a lot of the ideas in that course are already on the internet for free. And like I wrote this really big guide about like one of the main topics in the course. But I think the reason people pay for the course is because people want to learn in video form, not necessarily because like there's content that isn't in that post. Like, of course there is a lot of content that's not in the post, but still, like, I think generally most people who do like educational content that I know of, if you really wanted to, you could basically piece together most of the ideas that's in the commercial products by just like listening to every podcast interview they've done, reading every blog post they've written, you know what I mean? Just kind of like collecting all the information yourself. So it's usually not the case that there's like hyper gated secret content. It's just you're paying for like the convenience and you're paying for like the delivery mechanism, whether like, you know, I really like watching videos or I think like they're higher bandwidth, so I learn more than I do from like the written one, or there's like a Slack channel where I can ask questions. You know, there's a lot of other like value adds, but
you know, when is the right time to make video content versus written course content? You know, Refactoring UI could have maybe been a super long video.
Okay, so there's a couple pieces to it. I think video content is great for like learning lots of stuff, like programming stuff. I think video content is awesome. I learned so much more watching videos than I do reading stuff, because you learn things that the person wasn't even trying to teach you. And I think the same could have been true for like refactoring UI and like design stuff. But I also think there's a smaller potential market for video stuff because so many people just don't feel like they have room in their life to actually watch it, whereas like reading an ebook, there's so many more situations you find yourself in where like you can pass the time doing that. Like, you're waiting at the doctor's office, you can read the ebook. You can't really like watch a video course quite as easily necessarily. I think written content has a lot of advantages over video content in the sense that like it's searchable and like highlightable and copy and pasteable and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
But I think video content is easier to charge a higher price for, which can be really important if you don't have a huge audience and you need to make sure that you're going to get a good return on your time invested. You know, even if that means you're only going to sell like a few hundred copies or something. But with Refactoring UI, we felt like we were going to be able to sell, you know, thousands of copies of it. So it was okay to sort of do like a written thing and not worry about the pricing as much. Although we did definitely charge like a premium price tag for it because we were worried about that a little bit. Like, we do want to make sure that we maximize our return on it. So, you know, eBooks typically have like, there's like a market rate for it, right? It's like $29 or maybe like $49 is sort of the most someone is like sort of conditioned to be willing to spend on like a book or an eBook. So what we did is we bundled like 3 screencasts with the book and offered that for $79, which is a little bit more money than like you can really realistically easily charge for a book. And people are more willing to pay it because they don't have this like voice in the back of their head saying, like, are you crazy? Like, you're paying $79 for a PDF. Even though, like, of course, that's like the wrong way to evaluate whether something's worth buying. You know what I mean? Like, if it saves you an hour of time or helps you get a client that pays you an extra $100 because the results are better designed than they would have been before you read the book, like, it's paid for itself, obviously. But again, there's just something about like the delivery mechanism that just like reduces the price. So by being able to sort of add a couple bonuses here and there and sort of get people out of that mindset of evaluating as purely an ebook, it makes it easier to charge what you think the content is actually worth.
Quickly on the pricing tier again, is it vital to have 3 tiers or 2?
I think both options can work. I think the important thing is to have multiple tiers if you can. So we did 2 for Refactoring UI. At one point we were planning to do 3, and right when we were about to release it, we actually only planned to do 1, which was just going to be the $149 tier. But then we got a lot of feedback from people complaining about the price, and it kind of like scared us. So we introduced like the cheaper tier with a lot of the bonuses cut out. The way to think about it, right, is your goal with tiers is to give people who would be happy to pay you more money the opportunity to pay you more money. So if you write a book that's like, and you're going to sell it for $49, well, now the most someone can pay you is $49. So even if there's 15% of your audience out there who would have been happy to give you $150, like, they don't have any way to do it. Ideally what you want to do is figure out a way to add some additional content or perks to that lets you raise the price without necessarily like tripling the effort, right? Because that's, of course, like, now you're not really getting a ton of benefit from it, like, because you're charging more, but you're working way, way, way harder. So for my stuff where I've done like, my first book where I did 3 tiers, the book is for sure the heart and soul of sort of the product. And then like there's a second tier that includes the book plus videos, and the videos are all based on chapters in the book. I just like recorded, I took like the examples from the book and recorded them in screencast format. So it is more work because I had to make the videos and stuff like that, but I didn't really have to like invent new ideas or anything like that. It was, people are paying just to like get that same content in like a different format where they think they might learn stuff that they're not going to learn reading the book, or where they might absorb it in a different way because they prefer video content or whatever. Mm. So that was like another week of work probably. But that's like not that much really. And again, it was mostly mechanical work. It wasn't like creative work because I didn't have to like invent new content. And then the third tier, I included the source code to an application that I built that I already had built the year before, where I just happened to use a lot of the ideas that I espoused in the book, because that's kind of where I really like fine-tuned a lot of the things that I ended up teaching in the book.
That was Kytil.
That was Nitpick CI, actually. So that was no work really, because I just like threw the source code in a zip file and just attached it, right? And charged an extra $100 for it, which is totally worth it to the people who,
amazing,
who paid for it. But I didn't have to put a ton of extra effort into it.
Yeah, win-win.
And then for the advanced view course that I did 2 tiers on that, but I kind of did it the opposite way, where instead of like coming up with new stuff to be able to charge more, I thought of it as more like a 1-tier product. It's like $139. Here's all the videos. But then I cut a bunch of videos and kind of put together more of like a basics version of that course, or kind of like an essentials version, that didn't have as much of the content, charged less for that, and mostly used that like as a price anchoring mechanism. Right. So I think that's like $99. So I think there's like a $99 option and a $139 option, and the $139 one, you get like twice as much content, you know? So it just like helps people look at the 2 options and think, well, yeah, this $139 is like a good deal. And almost everyone bought that one. Barely anyone bought the other one. So it wasn't really meant to be like a real option. It's more just like, get people to like look at the 139 price a little bit less biased and like think, okay, this is what it costs for less videos, this is what it costs for more, instead of just thinking like, oh, this is too expensive. It sort of clears that thought from your brain a little bit and just helps you just focus on the value that you're getting.
Totally.
Yeah. And then for refactoring UI, we wanted to just do the one tier, but we ended up doing something similar to the Vue course for that same reason, just to like help people see past like that gut reaction on the pricing and also offer an option for people who just really didn't care about the bonus content and wanted to save a little bit of money. I think a mistake that people make with tiers is, again, the goal is to give people the option to pay you more money, right? For the most part.
Yes.
So you don't want to like tier down. You always want to like tier up. So if you have a product, like I had like my test-driven Laravel course, and that's only a single tier. Originally, I planned to do more tiers that just had less content and offer them at a lower price. But then it occurred to me, like if I think this is the course, why should I be giving people the choice to pay me less? You know what I mean? Like, just like keep it all as like what it is, and people can pay the price or don't pay. And I think I probably made more on that because of that.
What a great takeaway. So, you know, I gave a talk in Berlin in June. I was speaking at WordCamp Europe, and my talk was about landing pages and just understanding what makes them convert and so on. And afterwards, you know, people would go up to me in the, you know, from the audience, and they would say rad talk or so on. And then I would ask them a question about my potential landing page masterclass. It was so, like, it couldn't have been a better pool of data I'm getting here. This is someone who's just watched me, you know, talk about landing pages. Now I'm talking about a class I'm about to sell them. I would give them a few options, and every single one of them said, please do not make a free course because I need to be accountable. Like, I need to pay for it so I finish it. Because I said like, hey, I'm thinking of just putting it on YouTube, 10 chapters. I'll make money through a sponsor or affiliate income.
Yeah.
Or I'm just going to charge. And they were like, no, please don't put it for free. I will never watch those videos.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Like, I know like a lot of people would do courses where they sort of bring people on in cohorts so that there's like a weekly call where people can go and do like a Q&A based on like the content that they worked through that week or whatever. And that kind of gives you a little bit more accountability too, because it's not really like a consume at your own pace thing. Although of course, like you still have that option, but there's like something like nudging you to sort of keep up with other people and stuff like that. And I think, you know, charging money for something versus making it free is another good way in general to just like get people to take it a little bit more seriously and get them to actually work through the content.
I want to break into a second intermission I like to call true, false, or maybe. All you need to do is shoot back either of those three words, true, false, or maybe. You got it?
Got it.
A user interface is like a joke. If you have to explain it, it's no good.
True.
Designers should code.
True.
Laravel is the most exciting development on the internet in the last 5 years.
I don't have an answer for what is more exciting, so maybe, maybe.
Okay. You literally ordered an iPhone SE in the past month.
True.
Everyone should be working on their products in public.
False.
License plates in the Canadian Northwest Territories are shaped like polar bears.
Maybe.
People are still buying PDFs.
True.
And last question. Refactoring UI book has made more than $1 million.
True.
So trust me when I say I'm the last person who wants to talk about money, but I'm super interested what $1 million gets you in Canada nowadays. Can you even buy a house for $1 million?
You can buy a house for $1 million for sure, as long as you're not in like downtown Toronto or something. Yeah.
So your good friend and refactoring UI partner, Steve Sugar, you know, he's on the show, and whenever I dug deep, he would pause and say, nah, I must give Adam the credit for that.
Okay.
You know, you two seem like a great team. I want to know if the factors outside of a design development duo are the secret sauce for quality partnership.
Okay.
Both have kids. You both drink beers. You both dig a good dose of heavy music.
It's hard to say. Me and Steve are actually like, we have a lot in common, but like we're so different in so many ways too. Like, I don't know that we would have been like super good friends in like high school or like outside of like work. I think like work stuff is kind of like what connects us. And we sort of discovered that we do have like a lot of things in common, like outside of that too. Like we're both big fans of like early Green Day records and stuff, and have like stories to tell there. And you know, we both played instruments, and like he went to school for like audio engineering and I ran a studio, you know, so there's all sorts of cool little similarities there. But at the same time, like he like loves traveling and I hate traveling. Yeah. He like loves being in like in the city where there's like it's busy and there's all sorts of crazy stuff going on. And I just like want to live the most boring, like suburban life ever. So I think like we're very different in a lot of ways, but very compatible when it comes to like work stuff. And we have like enough in common outside of it that, you know, it's not just like this like pure mechanical work relationship either. So I think we're just kind of fortunate enough to get along and have like some things in common, but also just like be really compatible on the work side.
Brad, so right now you're developing, you know, Tailwind CSS full time. Quite a journey to get there for sure. Darshan from Product Disrupt asks, how do you decide which product to continue building on and which to stop?
Good question. There hasn't been that many things that I feel like I've like abandoned, I guess. Like there's definitely been like a couple. And I think the thing that they have in common is like there have been SaaS ideas. And I always get kind of like intimidated the further I get into like a SaaS product, because I know that it's a lot harder to get something like that off the ground and like get it sort of past that like critical point where it's like actually has some momentum and sustainable.
Yeah, that valley of death.
I think generally what's happened is I don't think I've ever like started building something and then like canned it with the plan, like with the thought, like I'm done with this. This was a bad idea. I'm never going to work on this again. But I do try to like evaluate all my ideas sort of in order of like what I think is the most guaranteed to like the least guaranteed in terms of like getting some return on the time invested into it. So I'm always trying to work on the idea that I think has like the biggest, most guaranteed chance of success. So for me, that was like I did the Refactoring the Collections book, and then there was a bunch of different things I could do after that. But I knew people wanted like the testing course, so I did the testing course. And then after the testing course, I started working on this like Kitetail SaaS app, which was sort of meant to be like my own personal Gumroad replacement, because at the time, Gumroad was sort of not really being actively developed because they had just like laid everyone off. And I know Sahil, who runs the company, was just sort of like feeling like he had failed because they didn't grow the way that they wanted to or weren't able to raise another round. And it just kind of like things went quiet on that front for a while he sort of like tried to like reframe the situation and like look at things in a positive light. And during that period was like when I was like right in the heat of like building and selling all my stuff. And I thought like, you know what, I love this platform, but I feel like one day it's just going to stop working because it feels like no one's working on it. So started working on a replacement for that. Eventually, like a couple factors. One, like Gumroad started being actively developed again, and I started like talking to Sahil a lot and kind of like rekindled my like confidence in the platform. And now like it's awesome, and it's awesome to see how much stuff they're developing. Like I can send them like a DM with an idea for a feature and they'll build it within 2 weeks. It's amazing. So now it's like, okay, I don't want to build this like horrible payment taking platform where I have to deal with all these fraud concerns and all this stuff. So I kind of put that on the back burner for that reason. And also because I had this idea for this Vue course and I had to like sort of evaluate, okay, I can only really spend my time on one thing. So should I work on this like SaaS thing, which is sort of targeted at people who want to sell stuff online, which isn't really like my audience. Like I definitely have people who follow me for that reason, or other developers who sort of have aspirations of making courses and stuff like that. But for the most part, people follow me because they, especially at that time, because they're excited about learning stuff in Laravel and in Vue. And, you know, these days it's a lot more because of like Tailwind CSS and stuff like that. So, yeah, I had to decide like, okay, do I keep working on this SaaS app that, is going to be hard for me to find customers for, or do I just work on this Vue course idea that came to me one day where, you know, there's this really exciting sort of like topic in the Vue community that I think I'm one of the first ones to be talking about. People seem to be really responding well to the content. I could do a course about this and guaranteed it's going to work out. So like that whole course from like idea to launch, I think was like 6 or 8 weeks. So I just put everything on hold and worked on that because I knew that was like the most guaranteed thing. And then after that was when me and Steve sort of started working hard on refactoring UI. And again, that was like, this is the most guaranteed thing. You know what I mean? Steve had built like a huge audience. People were like begging him to put out some sort of course or book. So like, why work on a SaaS app that has no guarantee of success at all when I could work on this thing that's like definitely a sure thing?
Hey, this is AJ from Yo Podcast Episode 1. You're already 30 minutes into this episode, so don't forget it's important to stretch and hydrate. Back to you, Rob.
Got you. So just say in a month period, how much do you work on your previous courses in a month?
Including like refactoring UI, not including refactoring UI, I probably spend a total of 30 minutes a month, maybe answering emails from people who like forgot what account they logged in with and or need me to transfer their access to a different GitHub account, like customer support stuff. I don't do anything in terms of like updating content or anything like that. Like I consider the products done.
That's incredible.
And then with refactoring UI, that's a little bit more support because there's still quite a bit of activity on that. Like my other stuff has slowed down a lot more. But refactoring UI, I probably spend like 30 minutes a week or an hour a week at most on Help Scout, just like answering support tickets.
Ain't so bad. I mean, it's not exactly passive income because of the initial investment, but it is quite passive at 30 minutes a week.
It's passive in the sense that it's not like trading time for money.
Totally. Something they didn't teach us at school.
Yeah.
So what's your day to day like right now? You know, is it full-time Tailwind? And how do you start your day and end your day?
So right now, me and Steve are working on this like Tailwind UI project. So that's like what I'm spending most of my time on, which is meant to be kind of like a more opinionated sort of like component template layer on top of Tailwind. So me and Steve are designing and building a lot of examples. So here's like 15 nav bars built with Tailwind. Here's like 15... account settings pages or like site footers or heroes or feature sections, right? So just like building up this big directory of sort of blocks that you can sort of
components
snap together to put together a site with Tailwind and customize like to your heart's content. But yeah, it's kind of designed to serve as like sort of like an inspiration gallery, but where everything is right there in HTML, so you can just grab it and use it. So
beautiful.
Spending a lot of time working on that. So me and Steve will usually chat on Zoom or something for usually about an hour a day, kind of working through things together. And then he'll work on some stuff on his own. I'll work on some stuff on my own. I feel like I don't have like a really solid routine in terms of like how I divide my time. Like some weeks I have to record a podcast episode for Full Stack Radio. So that'll take up some time one day. Then I have to edit that at some point.
I have that too.
Some days I have to do, you know, administrative garbage for the business, like right now I'm in the process of filing taxes for my business, so I was just on the phone for half an hour getting a copy of a tax form. I try to keep on top of like the Tailwind issues, so I'll look at that at least a couple times a week. I'll usually kind of batch through that and try and close out 5 or 10 of them at the same time. Right now I'm also working on like some features for Tailwind. I haven't really been working on Tailwind itself for the last few months because I was kind of working on this Tailwind video course. I was working on a free course that I kind of just put in the documentation for people who prefer to learn that way. So I've been working on that. And I've kind of been like bouncing back and forth. So I'll do like a new course module for that like every other week or so. And then the next week I'll work on stuff with Steve. So it's kind of all over the place. And I think I need to do a better job at like planning that stuff and like defining like what I want to get done each day, because
roadmap.
I feel like I do a lot better when I know, like I used to do this thing at the beginning of the week where I'd sort of like write up, okay, if I got this and this done this week, I could call this week a success no matter what else I did this week. And that was working really well, but that doesn't come naturally to me. I have to sort of like force myself into that sort of routine. So it's easy to sort of fall off the wagon. And right now I think I'm in kind of a little bit of chaos land, but yeah.
I got a question here from Jake Hawks, and he says,
what do you feel are the best resources to learn the philosophies and application of Tailwind?
I think the documentation is the best place to learn most stuff, because I think I've tried really hard to make the documentation kind of like a combination of just how does the tool work as well as sort of like best practices guides, you know? So there's a lot of content in there about like how I think you should use it, not just like how it works, what the classes are, what sort of the configuration API is. Like it's a lot less mechanical than that and then like most other documentation sites, I think. So it's worth a read because a lot of it reads more like a tutorial and sort of like gives you opinions on stuff. I think the video course is even more in that direction. You'll learn a lot of stuff about like how I organize the classes or why I use multiple elements versus one element for some particular problem or whatever. And I also did a talk at Laracon this year called Tailwind Best Practice Patterns, which covers a lot of more opinionated stuff too. So I think those would probably be the resources that I can recommend with the most confidence because like I've created them myself.
Gotcha.
But there are a lot of other stuff out there too. Like there's like a video course on Egghead that a guy, Simon Racliotis or Racliotis made. But this was like, he made it way early in the Tailwind days. So before Tailwind 1.0. So things have changed a bit, but that's like another resource. And there's lots of articles and stuff out there too. But docs, Laracon talk, video course would be like the top three that I would recommend.
Got you. So I was studying the State of CSS report 2019. And, you know, even though Tailwind's pretty new, the satisfaction rate was pretty high, about 83%. Got a question here from Dennis. Do you think Tailwind will eventually catch up to Bootstrap?
I don't think it will quite catch up to Bootstrap because I think the landscape has changed a little bit since when Bootstrap first came out. I think Bootstrap was really like a game changer. It was almost like the first CSS framework in a lot of ways. It felt like, you know, they kind of like created the category. And that gave them like a huge boost in terms of visibility that I don't think anybody else is ever going to be able to compete with. And then I think on
first move advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. And then on top of that, I think like the ecosystem is fragmented a lot in terms of just like the way people build things. So now something like Tailwind isn't just like, you know, quote unquote competing with other CSS frameworks. It's also competing with like completely different CSS ideologies, like styled components or, you know, other CSS and JS tools. And I think a lot of those tools are really promising and make a lot of sense if you're building something like that's a full on React application, for example. So I don't think anything really has the potential to ever achieve like Bootstrap status. But I do have optimism that Tailwind is going to be considered like a pretty kind of standard and common choice for people who are still building stuff where they're using like traditional CSS files, like global CSS.
Okay. So where is YouTube right now? I know you're live streaming a ton. You really enjoy it.
Sure.
But YouTube's a bit of a wild place right now to create content.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really think of myself as like a YouTube creator, really, for sure. I definitely treat YouTube as more like an archive of my video content that I've put out for free. So I don't really think about YouTube too much, but I do think that there's still like a lot of potential there. I think like this generation that we live in, like even me personally, like YouTube is the first place I look to learn anything. Like I needed to like sew a button onto my shorts that fell off the other day. And like, I don't know how to sew. So the first thing I did is I go on YouTube. I'm like, how do I like sew a button on this pants? How do I repair a button? Find a video, follow it, pants fixed, right? I think YouTube is like still, I think there's still a lot of potential there for people. I think in general though, like it's a good idea not to invest like all your eggs in like one basket. You know what I mean? It's good to kind of be present in a bunch of different places. Maybe like one thing works better than others. I think ultimate is to control it yourself. Like there's certain people I know that have done a really good job at just like building a really good newsletter where they have like a really captive audience and they can just like send their stuff directly to someone's inbox. There's like no risk of, you know, YouTube changing some rules that like screw up their channel or whatever, right?
Some algorithm.
So I think ultimately you want to own the means of distribution as much as you can. And the next best thing to that is to just not be beholden to like one place.
Absolutely. So if I'm not mistaken, you and Steve wrote a top five Medium article of all time. Is Medium still an avenue for marketing nowadays?
Good question. I don't know where it sits these days, but yeah, last year when we were kind of keeping on top of it, we had this like 7 practical tips for cheating at design post. That was like the 5th most clapped post of all time or whatever, which is really, really cool. These days, I think Medium is sort of on the way out. I think they are in like desperation monetization mode. Yeah. And sort of scaring away all of their readers, you know?
I agree.
So I wouldn't personally ever put content on Medium basically ever at this point. I think back in like the glory days of Medium, and even when we were posting our stuff to Medium, I think we were a little bit over the peak, you know, of like Medium's sort of impact. But I think like back in the day when, yeah, they were just burning through investor money and they didn't have to make any money or throw up these stupid paywall modals in people's faces, I think it was a really good way to spread, you know, a message or to spread some content around, because it did have a lot of like discoverability and stuff built into it. But these days, I think it's basically seen as like this like awful place, and everyone just says post it on your own blog, you know, and I definitely agree with that.
Hey friends, it's Rob from The Edit. I'm trying to keep the podcast ad-free, but I have put up a coffee donation page over at robhope.com/coffee if you're getting value from the show. Best you buckle up, as Adam's about to go all in. You've dabbled in SaaS income, but you've mainly got these products that are once-off purchases, yep. You know? So for me on my side, I don't have anything going that's got subscription.
Yep.
It kind of kills me. You know, Google sends me about 85,000 people per month, just organic traffic, and I'm not turning them into customers. Do you feel that not all products need to have subscription?
At a grand scale, I definitely think like subscription models, they're the right fit for certain things and not the right fit for other things. Like, I don't think any of the stuff that I've done so far would make sense as a subscription thing. I think when you're asking someone to pay you on a recurring basis, that introduces like so much friction into the purchasing process that isn't there when it's a one-time purchase. Like, there's no such thing as like impulse buying a subscription. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas like a course or a book, a lot of people buy them aspirationally. Like, I'm sure there's lots of people who have bought my stuff and haven't even read the book yet, you know, and it'd be great if they did, because I think they're going to get a lot out of it, but like they're also not like unhappy because of it.
For sure.
Whereas like if you start paying a subscription for something and you forget to cancel it and you see it show up on your credit card and you didn't even use it that month, it kind of makes you resent the person who sold it to you, which I think is not great. I think one-time sale products have a lot of advantages over subscription products for people in certain phases of their sort of entrepreneurial career. Like, they are a lot more front-loaded in terms of revenue. So like you have like a big launch, you make a bunch of money, and then it sort of like trails off.
Mm.
Whereas like SaaS is the opposite, or recurring revenue in general, like it kind of builds up slowly over time. So I think like one-time sales stuff can be like a really good way to quickly put a bunch of money in the bank and be able to sort of afford to own your own time, so you can invest time in things that are maybe like long-term plays, like recurring revenue stuff. But of course, like recurring revenue is recurring revenue. Like, that's the ideal for sure. So, but yeah, I think too, like one-time sales stuff can be recurring revenue in sort of a different way. Like, Refactoring UI still does about $60,000 US a month in sales, and it's a one-time sale product, but it consistently does 60 grand a month. So it's like me and Steve have a SaaS business with 60K in MRR. You know what I mean?
Nice.
We don't really think about it that way, but like in terms of like what ends up in the bank account every month, it is the same. And I think there's good examples of people who have done a really good job at taking one-time sale stuff and creating systems around it to sort of make them sell for the long term. You know, like Brendan Dunn is a good example. I know he's done a lot with his like double your freelancing stuff to make the revenue on that a lot more consistent, even though it is like a one-time sale thing. So I think even though like subscription stuff is considered like the holy grail and everybody wants to have like recurring revenue and start a SaaS or whatever, I don't think that's like the only path. And I think like you're probably doing entrepreneurship on hard mode if that's like the only option that you're willing to explore.
Second last question we just got from Candace. And she says, Adam, you've successfully taken the leap You're working for yourself. You know, what advice could you give me just to start going in the right direction of eventually getting there?
Okay, big question. A couple important pieces of advice. One would be build an audience. I think that's the most important asset you can have, especially if you're trying to, if you want to take this path of being able to do like some sort of like one-time sale or informational product and use that as maybe a way to help bankroll investing in building a SaaS business or something eventually. I think having an audience like is beneficial no matter what. And I think having a big audience of people that trust you can make up for a lot of other mistakes or so-called deficiencies, like in your, say, marketing strategy. You know, if you have a huge audience of people who think you're awesome and have gotten a lot of value from you, you're going to make more money on a one-time sale product than someone who has like 1/100th the audience size, but has done everything right in terms of all their email marketing and like their landing page optimization and all that stuff. Like all that stuff is helpful, right? But I think like the audience size and like the audience's opinion of you as like the person they're following can like make up for any mistakes that you make anywhere else. So I think like that's your highest leverage thing. Mm. So ways that you can build an audience. I mean, if I had to distill it down into the simplest sentence possible, it's just be helpful on the internet. So write blog posts. That's one way to be helpful on the internet. Live streaming is another way to be helpful on the internet. Creating YouTube videos, you know, that's being helpful. Answering or helping people who have questions on Twitter is a way to do it. Creating an open source library is a way to be helpful on the internet. I don't think you have to necessarily be inventing content either, like hosting a podcast where you're not the person delivering the value, you're just the person asking good questions and curating, you know, the guests that you have is a great way to build an audience too, even though you're basically curating value being delivered from other people. Like that's what I do with my podcast. And you know, that's helped me a lot. So I think just being helpful on the internet and being worth following, you know, like you want people to be able to answer this question, like why should I, you know, pay attention to like what this person is doing, or why should I give this person like the opportunity to sort of inject anything into like my stream, you know? And I think it's short-sighted to think that that has to be in the form of like writing blog posts or creating videos. Like all that stuff works, but you can be a lot more creative in like the ways that you be worth following. But at the core of it, yeah, be worth following and try to be like as selfless as possible with that stuff too. Like you want your signal to noise ratio to be like very good when it comes to like the stuff you're putting on the internet. If you're delivering a lot of value on Twitter, but like 75% of your tweets are you like complaining about how you got a flat tire and now you have to like sit at the shop, like nobody gives a shit. You know what I mean? Like
yeah, just ranting.
Don't like be selfish with like the stuff that you share. Mm. Just try and focus on
adding value.
I think that's the best way to build an audience. And once you have an audience, it's a lot easier for you to sort of notice like what your audience is following you for, you know, and that'll give you ideas for, you know, it seems like people think that I know a lot about this topic, and I guess I do, but I didn't realize that I knew more about this than other people. So maybe there's an opportunity here for me to create some commercial product to help other people learn this. You know, there's been so many things for me that I sort of take for granted that I know a lot about that other people don't. You just kind of assume that anything you know, everybody knows, but that's totally, totally not true.
Interesting.
And then the other thing is just like work in public. So it's all kind of related, but part of building an audience is just like, yeah, being worth following, being interesting. If you are working on something interesting, letting other people sort of follow your journey on that can be interesting to a lot of people. Like developers love to watch other developers program and solve problems and stuff like that. And the developers doing the work sort of, it's easy to assume that that's not true. Like Taylor Otwell, who created Laravel, he open sourced a code base a while ago to a SaaS app that he built but never launched. And people were so excited about it. You know what I mean? Because, wow, we get to like study how this person we respect builds applications. And he ended up taking it down because like some people were complaining about things and it was just like not worth the hassle, but I think that's just something that comes along with having a huge audience of people. But yeah, even for me, like when I was working on Kitetail, which is like the SaaS app that I never finished and probably am not going to ever pick up ever again, I built like a little custom CSS framework for building that site. And in all the live streams, I live streamed like every line of code that I wrote for that app, basically. And the goal was thinking, okay, well, people follow me because like they care about like test-driven development. They care about Vue, you know, Laravel stuff. So I'm going to build this Laravel and Vue app. I'm going to do it all in public. People are going to watch. Might not help me get more customers for the SaaS app, but it will help me if I do another course. It helps me just stay engaged with my audience, whatever. And then it turned out like the most common question I got on the live streams was, what CSS framework is this? What CSS framework is this? It never even occurred to me that anyone would care about what I was doing with the CSS stuff. But because I was live streaming on my work and building it in public, I was able to pick up on the fact that people were excited about that. And that CSS framework ended up being Tailwind CSS. And now like that's the thing that I'm like the most well known for and spend all my time on. I never would have even done it if I wasn't live streaming myself building the SaaS app that went nowhere.
Fuck, that's such a good reply. That's it, dude. I saved this one. This is my most important question for you. So you had a recording studio called The Batcave.
Yeah.
Then on YouTube, you uploaded a video of you jamming to Decrepit Birth cover. And in the background's a Batman poster on the wall. Are you a Tim Burton and Joel Schumacher Batman, a Christopher Nolan Batman, or a DC Universe Batman?
I think the Christopher Nolan Batman movies are the best Batman movies, although the Tim Burton ones hold a special nostalgic place in my heart too.
Amazing. Adam, thank you so much. I've queued the hardest track I could find on the Epidemic service. Okay, yeah, thanks for being on the show, dude.
Thanks for having me, man. Really appreciate it.
Can you believe we're only 8 episodes in and the value extracted from these flipping legends is just incredible? If you're still listening, you are what I refer to as my people. Please email me at mypeople@robhope.com. I want to send you something small. Catch you in the next one with Jeff Sheldon from Ugma.
Story about that too, actually, like the most depressing story you'll ever hear in your life. Exciting but depressing in a lot of ways. So
I mean, if you want everyone to hear it, let's go.
This was like 2001. I was 14. I used to like hang out on the internet all the time, right, when I was like in my early teens. And Pantera had like a chat and forum,
yeah,
back in the day, like on their official website, moderated by this dude named Alfie. And I used to hang out in the chat and on the forums all the time, and I got talking to the dude that like ran the site somehow, just because I was around so much. So you just get into conversations with people and sort of, you know, kick up a little bit of like a friendship or whatever, even though this dude's probably like 22 or something and I'm like 13, 14 years old, you know. But yeah, I had been like hanging out there for years, and at one point when this show was coming up, this was like probably 2.5 months before the concert, he mentioned on the chat, like, I think I'm going to drive up and check out that show. Cause he was in like Pennsylvania or Ohio or something. So just like a few hours drive away from up here. And he said, I'll probably have like some extra like backstage passes or something. So, you know, I'll hook you up if I end up coming up there or whatever.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, that's sick. That's awesome. But that's like kind of the last like we ever talked about it. And like kind of forgot about it. So then like the day of the concert, I was like at school, came home from school. As soon as I got home from school, kind of just like started getting ready to go. And my dad took me and my buddy to this concert. Went to the concert. It was awesome. Came home from the concert. Next day, I went and checked my email. The dude who ran the site had emailed me that day before the day of the concert while I was at school saying, hey, I've got 4 extra passes. If you want one of them, meet me at this location at this time. I didn't get it till after the concert. If I had just like checked my damn email when I got home from school.
You were 14.
I would have been like a 14-year-old kid with backstage passes to see
Pantera
and Slayer, like my 2 favorite bands in the entire world. And is a pretty crushing thing to discover for sure.
Would have got photos of the whole crew.
And that would have probably been like one of the coolest memories of my entire life. And I missed out on that. So
I mean, I've seen Slayer a few times. I even actually got Dave Labotta's drumstick behind me right now on my shelf.
That's awesome.
Aren't you seeing them again? Or this year, or was that last year?
I am seeing them again, actually. So I'm flying to LA to see what's supposed to be their final show ever.
Yeah, at that venue in LA, and then they're going to play the other venue in LA next year. But
yeah, exactly. We'll see.
I mean, you saw them in 2001. They're probably going to play with the same 3 outros again. What, South of Heaven, Rain and Blood?
Yeah, they just play the same songs every time. It's getting a little tired, honestly.